Morning, please be seated. Mr. Oram, you are counsel for the appellants, and if you wish to reserve time, so state.
Yes, please, Your Honor, 5 minutes, please. May I please, my name is Christopher Oram. I'm the attorney for Eugene Nunnery. Mr. Nunnery should have his sentence of death reversed in this particular case, or alternatively, I would ask the court to remand this matter back for an evidentiary hearing. I was denied an evidentiary hearing when I made a reasonable request for one at the post-conviction level. If you notice one thing from the state's brief that I think is very interesting, they, on page 25 and page 26, talk about how the trial attorney made reasonable decisions, tactical decisions, not to put on a fetal alcohol doctor, a third one, or in fact, he didn't put on any at this trial. These are tactical decisions. How do they know they're tactical decisions? Why is the state able to say this was a strategic decision by counsel when there's no evidentiary here? Can I come before this court and say that counsel admits that what he did was ineffective? I'm sure this court would say, where do you have that in the record? I don't. I just think he's going to say that. That's what I hope he's going to say. That's what the state got away with. They get away with saying that this was a tactical decision, yet there was no evidentiary hearing. They had no doctor, because you need a doctor, a medical doctor, to say fetal alcohol. And they did not produce one in the first trial. I bitterly complained about that. And attached to my supplement in the lower court, I attached the testimony of Dr. Brown. Dr. Brown testified in Mr. Nunnery's other capital trials. He was not sentenced to death. And I will point out that since they did not have fetal alcohol, an expert in fetal alcohol testify in the trial in which he was sentenced to death, the jury rejected the mitigator of fetal alcohol. They rejected it. Yet when they put on the fetal alcohol experts from Seattle, Washington, in the other two cases, I have, if you look in case number C227198, the jury found that the mother abused drugs and alcohol during pregnancy. They also found the mitigator, that the brain damage was consistent with fetal alcohol syndrome. In the other case, in District Court 14, C227487, the jury also found that the mother was ingesting alcohol and drugs during pregnancy, and they also found partial fetal alcohol. So why is this not ineffective not to put on a doctor that is an expert in fetal alcohol? It makes no sense, and the state's argument makes little sense because they're ignoring the fact that it's not a strategic decision, nor do they have any proof of a strategic decision.
Mr. Oram, they did put on two experts about fetal alcohol in this case. Now, the fact that in the world there may be a better expert or somebody that might testify better, one, is that the standard that we're looking for? And two, your client's elocution in this case was also different than the other cases where he was quiet. So, I mean, there's a lot of factors that are happening.
Well, I'll deal with the second one first. He made this terrible statement. I quoted it in my opening brief, so there's no allegations. This was something the state had to bring up. He said he would do it again, and it is. It was bad. With regard to the two experts, they were not fetal alcohol experts. One was Dr. Orison, who is he's a brain doctor. He did an MRI. He is not qualified to say fetal alcohol, and neither was Dr. Consora. If you notice, one thing that I think is so important to this particular case is in the appendix from volume 3045 to 3137, Dr. Brown's testimony is contained. I've put it in its completion. Dr. Brown testified in a subsequent capital trial that Dr. Consora and Dr. Orison, those are the experts, they're just the starting point. They could not make that decision. So what we found was that in the records that a year after the trial, defense counsel is now hiring these experts and looking at them. And Dr. Brown testifies that that's just the start. Dr. Consora, Dr. Orison were the start. They could not come up with that conclusion. So they failed. They missed the boat. And I can't understand how the state says it's not ineffective, and I can't understand how I'm being denied evidentiary hearings. And I say evidentiary hearings because I've been before this court in other capital cases, specifically Chapel, where I complained that I didn't get an evidentiary hearing at post-conviction. I lost 7-0. Federal public defenders have gotten it. They've done an excellent job. They complained I'm ineffective because I didn't get an evidentiary hearing and didn't get fetal alcohol, which I requested.
Well, they'll do the same thing in this one.
They will.
Yeah.
And they got an evidentiary hearing. And I didn't. And I lost 7-0.
Maybe if we had judges who were 250 qualified, we'd have a different result.
Well, we have our attorneys
250 qualified, but our death penalty judges aren't 250 qualified, especially this one.
Well, it causes me grave concern that I'm before. It actually causes me grave concern that I'm testifying recently as to ineffective assistance on Chapel, as to why I didn't convince the judge not to get an evidentiary hearing and not to get fetal alcohol expert. But I requested both, and I came to this court and bitterly complained about it. I lost. Now I'm going to be ineffective or considered ineffective because I couldn't convince the district court judge to do that. And also, I'll remind this court in Hoover, which I also lost, another capital case, same judge, wouldn't sign the transport order once I got funding for fetal alcohol. So there's a pattern, a trilogy, Hover, Chapel, and this case.
So how do you establish the
Special Public Defender's Office to do these cases? And, I see the trial was two special public defenders, two female special public defenders who I know are excellent attorneys, as you are in the capital range. And why do you think you should second-guess what they did at trial?
Well, because they had an expert, Dr. Levinson, but Dr. Levinson was out of the country. And so the district court judge said, no, I'm not going to permit you this three-day continuance. So they didn't have that expert. I don't really know what that expert, how extensive that expert's testimony would be, but they didn't use them in subsequent trials. They used...
Mr. Orm, I don't want to cut you off, but I want to talk about this case because your time is ticking away. Kinsora and Orison both testified that the defendants was consistent with FAS. Dr. Brown testified it was consistent with FAS. So what's missing here? What am I missing?
Dr. Alder. Dr. Alder is the MD that Dr. Brown says makes the final decision because Dr. Alder has to do a physical exam. It's not sufficient. It is best explained by Dr. Brown between 3045 and 3137 or 3134. Dr. Brown makes it very clear that it takes an MD to make that decision. These other two doctors were just the starting point. One is he has to be an MD, so Dr. Kinsora can't do it, and Dr. Orison is not the specialty. He does, when he was alive, he did MRIs, or he conducted MRIs. So they've missed the boat. And they know they missed the boat, because why are they a year later contacting these experts, and then the ultimate result is he isn't sentenced to death in these other two cases? And again, I do want to concentrate on this case, but I'm seeing a pattern of being denied evidentiary hearings. And why are we going to say, is the court going to say this was a strategic decision? How do you know that? Why aren't I given a chance to put on witnesses? It's a capital case. What's the difficulty with this? And it just causes me concern that as a state post-conviction litigator on capital cases, that the federal public defender who is doing an excellent job then gets an evidentiary hearing when I'm denied one. And I don't understand that. We should be funded, and we should receive evidentiary hearings. We didn't in this case. And we could have called those doctors to prove. I don't really need to because we can look at Dr. Brown's testimony from the other trials, and I have attached one of them in completion. And you can see why reversal is mandated in this particular case. Also, Dr. Kinsora, before I forget, Dr. Kinsora was harshly cross-examined over the fact that the foster care records of Eugene Nunnery did not reflect anywhere fetal alcohol. Dr. Kinsora admitted, yes, that was bad.
Did you contact the trial attorneys to have affidavits that they're ineffective? To have them file with the judge to say, hey, I'm ineffective? I mean, believe it or not, we used to do that in the Clark County Public Defender's Office.
I think it's rare that an attorney...
Well, it wasn't rare when I was assistant public defender. We admitted when we screwed up.
You know, sometimes attorneys won't do that. That's why we have evidentiary hearings. That's why I requested them. And I think that when the state argues a strategic reason, then why am I not then permitted the opportunity to do so? But I do want to go, Dr. Consora was cross-examined over the fact that there were no records of fetal alcohol, and it looked bad, he looked bad, whereas Dr. Brown explained the whole history of fetal alcohol, saying that just until 2005, the Surgeon General of the United States told doctors, look for this carefully, that basically in 1980s, when Eugene Nunnery was growing up, nobody knows about this.
Did the jury find that as a mitigating circumstance?
In this case, yes. No, they rejected it. They specifically rejected fetal alcohol, and they found it in other two cases. And that is what I saw as a serious problem, because the difference is those experts. I see that I'm my best.
You have 4 minutes left.
What do you say for rebuttal? Mr. Stanton.
Let me begin by saying that the prosecution of Eugene Nunnery in three of these cases was interesting, to say the least. But I would respectfully caution the court to draw comparisons between the various trials by saying or concluding that the absence of what I'll call the Washington experts was the operative difference. It is, in my opinion, legally or factually impossible to draw an analogy between any of these cases. But I'd like to point out two hypercritical things between this case, the one where the death verdict was returned, and the other cases. The first one was, as Mr. Orms suggested and stated in his opening brief, probably an allocution that not too many people see, and no matter how long your career as a judge, prosecutor, or defense attorney. And not only did he make that allocution in front of the jury that was about to sentence him, but he did it in front of the surviving victims and the murdered victims' families, all who were in court at the time that he turned and looked in the audience. A fact that was certainly, pretty positive, not lost on the 12 that rendered their verdict. The second thing is Mr. Nunnery's murders of three different cases are substantively different, at least in one case, than the other two. In one case, the one case that he did not receive the death penalty by the jury, was of a murder of his connection to supplying narcotics that he was selling. And he was in a dispute with this individual about the amount of product, and led to him coming back and shooting him to death, and then some attendant victims that he had tried to kill that were witnessing the event and who did things that offended Mr. Nunnery, the young girl who was crying and had touched the body. The other case is mistakenly cited, and no fault of Mr. Orms, about the case that's similar to the facts of this case. That is, on a Friday evening, Mr. Nunnery and his cohorts went and looked for Hispanic males to rob of cash. And during that robbery, the offense, according to Mr. Nunnery, was to flee and not stay there, and that caused him to execute or attempt to execute the other individuals that remained. In the second case, in front of Judge Kadish, the jury did not come to a verdict. The jury in the penalty phase was hung. Judge Kadish used a statute that permitted her to enter a sentence of life without the possibility of parole, and thus the jury did not make that determination in the second case. And I think that's a substantive, significant difference. So those two things alone, and there are a lot more, that shows a separate and distinct difference between these cases. And Justice Chiarelli, you made a comment about the attorneys. There's actually, in all three of Mr. Nunnery's cases, he was represented by three lawyers. Each one of those lawyers were, in and of themselves, 250 qualified.
I understand the lawyers.
I was worried about the judges.
Yeah, you said two. And look, your point, especially when I tried the Amara Harris case, about 250 qualifications of district court trial judges, I think is an excellent idea. It's kind of absolved itself now because of the procedure in Clark County.
We've got the dream team now that have all been prosecutors.
Or four.
But they still haven't been defense attorneys.
And so the thing that Mr. Orm just said, I think, is significantly not true. And that is, he says, and I'm quoting here, that the doctors that testified in this case, two highly specialized doctors, were, quote, not qualified to render opinion of fetal alcohol syndrome. And then Mr. Orm cites to the transcript of Dr. Brown and some other cases. Well, let me address first the qualifications. That was never an issue brought up by anybody in that trial. In other words, the jury heard an unqualified, at least as far as restriction goes, of their opinions. And their opinions were significant and broad-based. We had a doctor who puts up, and as you see in the testimony in the record, this is a normal brain, and this is Mr. Nunnery's brain. And Dr. Orison, with this colored MRI, was a compelling witness that specifically addressed fetal alcohol and on direct or cross-examination denied my attempts to say that that brain damage could not be localized as to the etiology of the damage. And he says that the most likely explanation was fetal alcohol effect or fetal alcohol syndrome. So to say that they were not qualified to render that opinion, that's according to the Washington folks who testified later on, and clearly they had a vested interest in saying that we're the only qualified people because they are, and they're no longer used in the state system down there for reasons that I think are kind of self-obvious because of problems that they caused in other cases, but nonetheless, in front of this jury, their testimony was as two highly trained experts, and they had no problem expressing an opinion that the cause of Mr. Nunnery's mental problems was the result of fetal alcohol. And that was supported by one of the most compelling witnesses in the penalty phase, Mr. Nunnery's own sister, who testified that she was subject to fetal alcohol syndrome by their drug-addicted mother, as did several other family witnesses and the people best suited to testify to that fact. And so there is an abundance of evidence that was submitted to the jury in this case about that subject matter and that Mr. Nunnery was the victim of that condition.
But let me ask you this, though. As the prosecutor, and I've known you forever, and I know you do a great job when you prosecute, as Chris does a good job of defending these death penalty cases. Wouldn't it have been more efficient and save judicial resources to have a limited evidentiary hearing just on that issue? In other words, don't go into everything, but bring the attorneys back so that they could say, because I know as a defense attorney, I was on the stand a lot of times about whether I was ineffective or not in death penalty cases. But a limited evidentiary hearing so that you've got control over that, so that when the Ninth Circuit or a federal judge looks at it, they can see there was a limited evidentiary hearing. What are your thought patterns on that? Why not a limited evidentiary hearing with the trial attorneys coming forward and saying, you know what, we thought we had sufficient, and we're surprised the jury didn't find fetal alcohol syndrome?
I understand the issue, and I understand the question. I guess my answer to it, Justice Cherry, is then the rule should be that you always get an evidentiary hearing. Because I can't think of any other cases where you would sit there and say, no, we shouldn't have one. I mean, it, at some point, does it have any meaning about the qualifications of the attorneys? Does it have a meaning? Because my question is, what's the hearing going to produce? Their thought processes about what they wanted to do? You have three highly trained 250 qualified attorneys that aren't laying down and rolling over when it came to this case or any of these cases. They made a strategic decision that they had sufficient evidence to establish fetal alcohol. The jury disagreed with it, and so they changed their strategy in Nunneries 2 and 3.
Does the district attorney ever go to the trial attorneys to get an affidavit to say that they felt that there was a strategy move that they didn't get the third or fourth or fifth expert witness, not only this case, any case, to avoid the evidentiary hearing?
We certainly do that on occasion, not in written affidavit, but querying them as far as in preparation for an evidentiary hearing, or if the issue is raised by people of the quality of Mr. Orem to sit there and say, okay, what would your response be if under oath at this evidentiary hearing, and then assess whether or not we do have a problem of Strickland. But in this particular case, this penalty phase was incredibly effective, and so was Dr. Orson and Dr. Consora, who all of which have been not only routinely used in capital litigation before and during this time period, but since then. I think Dr. Orson has passed away. This effect of the Orson-Consora aspect was prevalent and effective by any number of capital defense lawyers at the time. And the fact that Washington then came in for a brief period of time, frankly marketing themselves as such, and I think that speech, when you look at the record of the cross-examination of especially Dr. Brown and Nunneries 2 and 3, it's to me quite evident that the only qualification from their perspective was a licensed physician, in their opinion, is the only person that can make the assessment of a fetal alcohol effect or fetal alcohol syndrome. I don't believe that position is universally held, but whether it is or it isn't, it had no import in this case because that issue was never presented to the jury. Their opinions came in completely unvarnished and without any restrictions or impediment, either by direct or cross-examination. The only other issue that I wanted to bring to the court's attention was the issue of the court's ruling about the defense investigator not being permitted to testify. The one thing that's missing from, I think, the direct connection in the original brief is that Willie Nunnery, the person who authored this, was in prison at the time that he was interviewed by the defense investigators. There were a number of family members that could have, that testified, and were in better position to testify about fetal alcohol than Mr. Nunnery, Willie Nunnery. And in addition, there was an aunt who was positioned probably better than anybody, but she refused to testify, and that's spread in the minutes of the court and the record down below, on behalf of the defendant, both in this trial and each of the subsequent trials of Mr. Nunnery. Unless the court had any other questions of me, I will submit the matter. Thank you very much.
First of all, I would like to point out that in a capital trial, it makes no difference. In all three of these capital trials, the facts would have been very similar, not in the guilt portion, whether deciding if the person is guilty of that murder or not, but in the penalty portion, when a jury is deciding, they hear about the defendant's background. So all three of these juries would have heard about all of these murders. So I take issue with the fact that, oh, there's different facts. Those facts all come out the same. Now, I'd like to go through a few of these things to make it very clear what I'm saying. They said, the government is saying, that the other two experts in this trial said there was fetal alcohol. I'm reading you from reading a portion of Dr. Consora surmised that Mr. Nunnery may, and I cite that on page 18 of my opening brief, from volume 9, 2126 to 2127, may. Didn't say he had it. Then we go over and we see that the state argues in their brief that counsel decided not to call a third expert because it was strategic. That's what they say on page 25. What am I leading to? We then go to Dr. Brown's testimony, and this is in our record, Dr. Brown's testimony 3064. Today, the standard, the generally accepted standard, is a multidiscipline team assessment, including at least three specialists. They didn't have three specialists. So Dr. Brown is saying, if we look at Dr. Brown's testimony, one of the foremost leading experts, that in the first trial, they didn't even have enough experts. nor was anyone qualified to make this decision because, as Dr. Brown said, it has to be an MD. It can't be Dr. Consora. So as I look at all of that, I ask the court, why is there not a limited evidentiary hearing? Why are the questions coming about what, because that's really what I heard. What does counsel think? What, Justice Cherry, that's what you're asking, is what did Mr. Sheik, what was he thinking? Maybe he has an answer. Maybe they told the judge Dr. Levinson was going to be out of the country. But why don't we have answers for this, for a proper appellate review? Because if we don't hold an evidentiary hearing on this case, maybe I'm going to be on the witness stand 2 years from now explaining why I can't convince courts to give me an evidentiary hearing, which doesn't make any rational sense to me. It's something that should be perfected. I should be able to argue what the attorneys believed. I'm not somebody who takes a long time. I try to get to the point in these evidentiary hearings. There are judges that give them to me. Sometimes they give them to me and I think they're going to deny them, and they do. But at least then there's a perfect record. And I heard the state argue that you should give them in every case. Unfortunately, maybe I've had one or two post-convictions in my career where I've written them, and I know what the court is going to do because I'm struggling to find legitimate issues. And so as I go to the court, I realize there's probably not grounds for an evidentiary hearing, and this court's going to ignore it. But here there was. And I think that when I hear the questioning today, it's proven because you're asking what were the decisions. Why can't I have that evidentiary hearing?
Mr. Orm, did you provide a declaration or an affidavit from an attorney that this violated the standard of care?
No. And I do not do that. I request evidentiary hearings because...
But you have to make a showing to get an evidentiary hearing. So
that's
why?
True. But I'm getting evidentiary hearings quite often. I get them quite often with the way I do this. To go to an attorney and say, and tell the attorney, I'm going to write up a declaration for you, you're going to admit you're ineffective.
It doesn't have to be the attorney. It can be any qualified criminal defense attorney, 250, to look at something and say, hey, in this instance, a qualified attorney would have done X. I mean, we're trying to just get the threshold. What does the court need to grant you a hearing?
Well, that's why I attached Dr. Brown. And when I attach Dr. Brown does everything I need because that's the expert. How could an attorney say anything more important than what Dr. Brown...
Well, it says what Dr. Brown would have said, but it doesn't say why it wasn't cumulative. It doesn't say why those experts were poor. It's Dr. Brown's opinion. So the question is, what attorney's there to tie it up and say, by not calling Dr. Brown, that violated the standard of care? By not finding another additional doctor, that violated the standard of care?
To answer your question, I have just not. I know the federal public defender does that. They sometimes ask for declarations. I still don't think that's a standard to get an evidentiary hearing. I think I have raised what that standard is, and I think today the questioning proves my point, and that there's no answer as to what the attorney said. The state didn't do it either. They're just claiming it. They're saying it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
They're saying it's strategic, but they have no proof of it. And so I ask, remand this case for a limited evidentiary hearing. With that,
possibly. Thank you, Mr. Orr.
Thank you,
Mr. Orr, Mr. Stanton, as always, thank you for the preparation and the arguments offered this day. This matter will stand.